The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha Robinson cannot be here tonight because she's stranded in the Forbidden Zone. On the first half of this episode, we discussed Planet of the Apes, the 1968 science fiction classic that helped make the world safe for movie after movie featuring intelligent apes and their troubled relations with humans. These most recently include Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and the new-ish War for the Planet of the Apes, which trace the ascent of apes from lab experiments to competitors for dominance over the Earth. The film is directed by Matt Reeves, who took over the series from Rupert Wyatt after the first entry. The third film continues a series-long shift away from humanity and toward the apes. Where Rise introduced Caesar, the intelligent chimp played in each film by Andy Serkis, and the first wave of intelligent apes, and Dawn more or less gave equal time to humans and apes, War is told almost entirely from the apes' perspectives. After the explosive finale of Dawn, the apes have attempted to carve out a place to call their own away from humans. But a relentless colonel, played by Woody Harrelson, has other plans. We'll talk about what the film is trying to do, how this chapter fits into the preceding films, and its relationship to the 1968 original after this.
We are not savages. Apes fight only to survive.
Bad human kill.
Ape.
All dead now, a long time. Long time.
Bad humans.
Soldier.
Years from now, your children will ask you, what did you do in the greatest war? And you can tell them, I fought to protect this world.
And the world's for a goddamn boy.
We created them. But now, we will bring an end to their kind.
No peace. This is war. Apes together strong.
Okay, general discussion here. What did you think of War for the Planet of the Apes?
I thought it was stunning. I loved it. I thought it was the strongest and most resonant of the three new ones. It's exquisitely directed, and the effects are incredible, and there's a whole lot to think about. I was shocked to the degree to which, and I'm sure we'll get into this, your sympathies lie entirely with the non-humans. And I thought it was a great payoff, and it really kind of leads into, and watching it with Planet of the Apes and seeing how it kind of leads into it in its way, just made it all the better for me. So I just loved it.
Yeah, I co-sign your general feelings on the movie. But as far as like how it sets up the 68 Planet of the Apes, I was like spending a lot of time thinking about that because I saw this movie knowing that we were doing this pairing. And it's like very, I think, strange in that respect, like how it does set it up versus how it doesn't. But we can get more into that in Connections. But I actually went back to rewatch Rise after seeing War for the Planet of the Apes. And that movie, which I also like quite a bit, but it's a lot more awkward and stilted in the way it calls out to the original series. War for the Planet of the Apes, you can just feel it becoming a much more assured series over the course of these three movies. And War is definitely the apex of that, where it really becomes its own thing, even as it is simultaneously informing this vast franchise.
Yeah, I feel like Matt Reeves kind of snuck in through the back door to become a really interesting director of big films. I mean, he did Cloverfield, but he didn't really necessarily get the credit for Cloverfield. And he
Let Me In,
the remake of Let the Right One In, which I liked quite a bit. I mean, it is very faithful to the original, which was the main criticism of it at the time, but I think it works quite well. And I think there's the moments that it diverges from it are kind of, you get a glimpse of the stylist he'd become with these Apes films. And this is quite good. I think I like the second one a little better. Because I love the balance it strikes between the worlds of apes and the worlds of humans. But this is quite a remarkable film. I was very pleased with it.
It's bold, though. I mean, it's bold to not strike that balance.
Yeah, and bold and kind of inevitable. We've been heading in that direction through the whole series.
And it's just drawing from a lot of different, I think, cinematic traditions. I mean, obviously, we've been doing a lot of war movies lately, guys.
Yeah, we'll do another one next time. There's a lot of them.
But I mean, you know, obviously it directly references Apocalypse Now, but it's also like there's a interview with Reeves on Entertainment Weekly where he kind of talks about the different films he watched as, you know, inspiration for these, like not as like a direct inspiration so much as what he characterizes as creating a vibe for the film. And he calls out Bridge on the River Kwai, mm-hmm. which I think is very apparent. The Great Escape, also very apparent. But he also notes biblical epics, which I think like this is a very strong Exodus story in a lot of ways. And I think that kind of functions as a metaphor and allegory that can be applied to a lot of different contemporary issues. So I think that's a very smart approach on the filmmaker's part. And, you know, it's also informed by the Planet of the Apes series.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, Apocalypse Now mm-hmm. is a pretty big mm-hmm. Influence in Full Metal Jacket as well. Both of those films are referenced pretty directly.
Yeah, I mean, it lays on the biblical references and the Apocalypse Now references very heavily, but it feels earned. It feels like we at this point in the series that it can bear that kind of weight.
Yeah. One other reference point he mentions, which I'm not super familiar with, but I think you two will react to, is the outlaw Josie Wales.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
In that
western,
the last shot,
kind of snowscape western. Yeah,
yeah. The last shot of the film is from some western. I can't remember. It has to be, right?
I mean, that to me is like very much the Exodus nod.
Maybe I'm
that,
just thinking
that
of the
shot,
image
the land
of that
of milk and
image
honey.
of it, kind of like
it's a little Shane
craning up.
A little Shane, like although Shane doesn't crane up, but just having the
It feels like there's a John Ford film that is it maybe My Darling Clementine or something that has a shot like that, but. In any case, Matt Reeves knows his cinema pretty well.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you have sort of the three kind of big pillars of classic studio filmmaking. You have war movies, you have westerns, and you have biblical epics, you know, and they're all kind of converging to inform this film.
That is true. And
a science fiction film.
And you have, I mean, what's surprising to me about the movie is how much Koba's notion of humanity and how the world works is the prevailing one, is the one that mm-hmm. the film lands on. And that's a really bold, because Koba's presented as villainous. And that changes in this movie. And I think it's, again, it's just so surprising. I just, when you're in the middle of a summer when movies play it so safe, to be given a movie like this, which would potentially endorse or prop up the point of view of a villain from the previous film, and that would align itself against humanity. I mean, that's a huge gamble and pays off.
It's basically making an X-Men movie in which Magneto is right, which is kind of what Logan was in some ways.
True.
But I mean, it's been, I don't know. I think this, and as long as we're talking about Logan as well, are an example of how you can, I don't know, you can make a blockbuster that's got a personal vision to it that doesn't conform to, you know, doesn't check off all the boxes, and audiences will still go to it. This was a hit.
Kind of like Planet of the Apes in 1968. Kind of like
Planet of the Apes in 1968. The secret is always put in talking apes. That's what you mean.
Yeah, it gets people thinking.
So here's my question, because it's, I don't think it's often that we talk about a second sequel as a standalone film on this podcast. So I'm curious, how do you guys think this movie stands apart from the two movies before it?
My memory of the previous two is not as strong as I think it should be, other than remembering James Franco from the first one and remembering Gobo from this one, and kind of having a sense of how Caesar fits into each of those scenarios. That's what I really remember about the previous two in comparison with this one. I will just say broadly that I felt more engaged and captivated by this one than the other two.
I forget which one of you said this like literally 5 minutes ago, but the idea that the series shifts from having kind of a human sympathizing perspective in Rise to a kind of parody between human and ape perspective in Dawn, and then kind of being fully onto the ape perspective in War, does, I think, serve to give these three films their own distinctive characteristics beyond the larger trilogy. I don't know if that was intentional. I hope it was, because I think it is really effective in making these three movies kind of stand on their own as well as within the larger story that's being told.
Yeah, I think they all have a different kind of flavor to them as well. Mm-hmm. The first one is, I don't want to say conventional, but it's definitely, you know, grounded in our world. And
it's an apocalypse story.
Yeah, and the second one is in a post-apocalyptic story in many ways. And this is that as well, but also all the other genres we mentioned before. They're distinctive in their way, which is part of what I think makes this an interesting series.
Well, but you also enter a rebirth or a passageway, a literal passageway to a sustainable future away from war, away from all the trouble that these apes have had to go through in these first two movies.
Yeah, and it felt like I think they're leaving the door open in interviews to doing more films, but this is definitely the end of this trilogy, and it's a nice progression, and it's ultimately, you know, pull back and look at a big picture. It's Caesar's story that's being told, mm-hmm. and we get that from beginning to end in a really satisfying way with these three films.
Yeah, I think Caesar is going to go down in film history as one of like the great characters. You know, I think Andy Serkis's performance is a huge part of that, but also the fact that he does have such a distinctive and well-drawn arc through these three films. It's interesting to have a non-human character kind of potentially stand that tall in the film canon.
And I think it may be as far as we've seen, as complex a character as we've seen that has been that effect reliant.
Right.
You know, if Andy Serkis walks down the street, nobody knows who he is. But
it's starting to change.
Yeah,
I mean, he's done enough promotion for these films.
Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe at this point. They wouldn't have
from this. Hey, look, it's the editor from 13 Going on 30.
Though I will say, as great as great, I mean, Andy Serkis is fantastic in this movie. But boy, Steve Zahn, how great is Steve Zahn?
Yeah, we gotta talk about Bad Ape.
I actually, I only vaguely Googled for this, and couldn't find any clear answers. But was Steve Zahn doing the motion capture for Bad Ape, including the movement and stuff as well?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
It was like Serkis, a full motion capture performance.
Good, yeah, because Bad Ape is amazing, and I would have been sad if that wasn't the case. So,
and you just need him so much. It's such a grim movie to have Steve Zahn pop in there and give you a little bit of comic relief and a little bit of play,
but it also
makes a big difference.
Also pathos.
Yeah,
he's such a traumatized character.
Yeah, and also like this deep into this story, I think it's really smart to introduce a different kind of ape, an ape who is separate from Caesar's or Koba's factions of apes. You know, it suggests a bigger world beyond this, you know, little sliver of the Pacific Northwest or West Coast.
Let's just say sure.
Yeah.
They started in San Francisco and they picked their way north. So yeah, that makes sense. You know what? He's really not such a bad ape.
He's not. No. I would go so far as to call him a good ape.
Yeah.
But he has the blue vest that I think kind of calls back to the costuming of the gorillas in the original franchise? Am I imagining that?
No, that's right. And then we get, of course, we get Nova over again, sort of.
The woman who can't speak, girl in this case, but yes. Is Maurice called Maurice because of
Maurice Evans? In the first film, there's a lot of naming after people. In production.
I didn't realize until now that she actually is Nova. That's,
mm-hmm.
Huh. That's interesting.
But she's named after the car.
Yeah, she is. She is. Well, I mean, what? Boy, that
it gives you a lot to think about, right?
Yeah.
Like, well, I was thinking about how are we supposed to see the continuity of this?
It doesn't work because it would make sense if the original Planet of the Apes took place like 10 years after the action of this instead of 1,000 years or however many it is.
Yeah. Well, the big thing is that Caesar's son is named Cornelius, and there's a character named Caesar in the original series too. So like,
it was Cornelius's son.
Yeah. So like, there's some confusion there as far as like the lineage goes, but I think, you know, if you just take it to be like ape society or like human society, where like people are named after ancestors, you know, and names are handed down, you know, but this is not the...
Or not strain too hard to make the connection there.
Right. But like, because I saw War before revisiting the 1968 original, we're probably getting ahead of ourselves, but I did spend a lot of time wondering if the Cornelius in War was supposed to be the Cornelius in the 1968 Planet of the Apes, and that was like a little distracting to the point that like I kind of wish they hadn't done that. But that's a minor complaint.
I think it's probably to the new film's favor that they're not prequels. They don't try to be prequels, because as an audience member, you end up anticipating all these events happening. Like, when is humanity going to have, when are they going to nuke each other? And how is this, this way you can be surprised by how things go and not be just sitting there just wondering what the origin of everything is.
I have a minor complaint too. In Dawn, I thought it was like, oh, wow, that's Judy Greer, but she doesn't really have much to do. Well, okay. Maybe her scene got cut. And then in this one, it's like, oh, good, Judy Greer's in this one. Oh, she doesn't really last all that long.
Yeah, I mean, for all it does well, this series, as well as, you know, the series that inspired it, does, you know, not have a wealth of great female characters, you know?
That is a generous way of putting
it. Yeah, but it succeeds in other respects.
Well, as long as we're talking about the 68 one, maybe we should move on to Connections, which we will do after this.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Have you finally come to save your apes?
I came for you.
For me? My God. Look at your eyes. Almost human. How did you know I was here?
I was told. You are coming. That more soldiers from the north would be joining you here.
Joining me?
To finish us off. For good.
Who told you that?
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about the things they have in common. You know, may as well start by talking about apes. Like, how are the apes in this different from the apes in the original Planet of the Apes?
I think the apes in War are a little more realistic than those of the original. If realism is the main quality you're looking for in your ape effects, but they both have their charms.
Well, I mean, we could talk more generally about mocap performances versus, you know, mask acting or make acting through makeup. I like both. And I think looking at them side by side, you can kind of see the advantages to each.
Right.
You wouldn't call it dated, Keith? Or you call
no,
it
I would not. I would not call it dated.
Be able to
no, I love the original effects.
Yeah. Well, and what I love about what these recent Apes movies have done with the effects from Weta is that they have taken motion capture and computer generated imagery to the point that actors can act through it, the way that actors can act through makeup. That wasn't always the case. That wasn't the case 10 years ago.
I mean, there's really just no barrier here between us and how, and the audience and how we think or how we connect or feel with these characters on screen. I mean, there's not, you know, whereas, I mean, you just expect that with any effect, there's going to be that wall and certainly a facial effect, you know, someone, or a character who's an ape, just such a full range of emotion, all the emotion you would expect from a human being, you know, turns up on, you know, Caesar's face, for example. I don't feel like there's any barrier at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's notable that both ape effects, both the makeup effects in the original and the motion capture effects here, leave the eyes pretty much unimpeded. Like, you are seeing more or less the actor's eyes. You know, it's such a cliche that, you know, the eyes are such a huge part of the performance, but they really are, especially in Caesar's performance.
Their window into the soul.
Yeah.
I thought that was the cliche you were going to mention.
It was, but it was a cliche, so I didn't want to say
okay.
it.
Okay. I'll take the hit.
But yeah, there is a comment in there about Caesar's eyes being so human and him more than any of the other mocap apes in this series has very expressive human eyes, which certainly contributes to his characterization.
The other difference, too, is that, you know, the apes are being attacked in this film in a very violent way. And there's something still more disturbing about it than if it were humans being shot. There's something just we at that point can see them as helpless animals.
Yeah, it's a way that you know, your heart kind of goes out when an animal's put in jeopardy in film. It's in a way it doesn't necessarily go out when there doesn't always go out when there's a human in jeopardy, and this is like kind of that writ large, isn't it?
Yeah, it can turn that quickly from seeing them as having the emotional range of a human being to seeing them as poor defenseless animals who are getting shot.
I think the movie plays with that a little bit too, because at the end you just get these sort of these throngs of humans that, you know, indistinguishable from one another, just a mass of, you know, the army invasion, and they're it's almost more like a force of nature than actual individual people doing it. And whereas the apes are always, you know, very, you know, set apart and independent characters at that point.
I want to talk about Apes on Horseback because I think like that is such an interesting visual throughout this series of apes riding on horses. And I remember, I think we saw it for the first time in this newer series in Dawn.
I believe so.
Yeah. And just the way that reveal happened, like the way you see apes on horseback for the first time, it's just like, it's such a very kind of stirring and unusual image to have an ape on the back of a horse.
It upends our perceptions of what, you know, where they are in the animal, in the animal hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the 68 original also has apes on horseback, but it's much more kind of matter of fact the way it's introduced. Like, it's how the apes are introduced. Like, the first That's time true. We see them is on horseback.
Well, I mean, domesticating and subjugating animals are one of the things that define
right.
what humans are. And suddenly we have somebody else doing that.
Yeah. So I guess, like, you know, putting this newer series in the context of prequels, like, it makes sense that we are seeing the moment where that happens, whereas in the 68 original, like, it's just, it's part of the society. But that is like a very powerful moment that always stuck out to me in Dawn, is the first time we see the apes on horseback and the first time we see them shooting a gun, for that matter. Like you said, it kind of upends our perceptions of what animals and beasts are.
Yeah, and it also brings us into the Western as well, right? To have them,
for sure.
To have them on horseback, and also, I guess, like the first a rejection or a treat, maybe by necessity, from a technologically based society into a more quote unquote natural way of doing things.
So, still got the guns, though.
They do have the guns. Well, I guess it's
and so grenades
by necessity. I guess I would explain that, but there doesn't. I don't think there's any rush to for any of them to be developing, you know,
a car
like Palo. You know, there's not a Palo Alto kind of vibe to the place, despite its location.
We should talk about audiences 1968. versus audience in 2017. And I think you could be like Don Draper and be surprised by what you'd seen in this one. And these series had to play to 21st century audiences that had already, you know, knew the tricks of the original Planet of the Apes. And how do you think these films give an audience like that something they haven't seen before? I mean, part of it's come from the effects, which we've already talked about.
Yeah, I think it's maybe just like situating it within the blockbuster model, which the 68 original, and I assume the latter films aren't really in, because the blockbuster model didn't really exist.
No, I mean, they're kind of like pre-blockbuster blockbusters a little bit.
Yeah, but they seem to almost like function more in the cult film realm, even though it was a huge hit, but just in terms of I don't know, the vibe of it, to go back to the vibe, which is a very technical film critic term that I'm using.
In the late 60s, it applies.
I think. Right? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there have been many people who have called War for the Planet of the Apes like the best blockbuster of the summer. And, you know, you can certainly argue that, but I think it is definitely a paragon of modern blockbusters. So I think the fact that it is like bringing what appealed to 1968 audiences into a format that appeals to 2017 audiences, you know, maybe a big part of its success.
I wonder to a degree how, you know, I mean, when we talked about Planet of the Apes, we talked about all of these themes that come out of it, you know, the themes of race and of, you know, science and reason and all of slavery. The Cold War. Mm-hmm. It's like all of these things are associated with it. There's so much to chew on there. Is there as much with these movies or with War of the Planet of the Apes?
I think so. I think it's a little more under the surface. But in the first one, you get into the issue of animal rights and experimentation. Mm-hmm. The second one, it's more like about a hot zone, more about like how do you share space with a warring, with your enemy? How do these warring factions that will never be fully reconciled live together or not, as the case might be. And this one, I think you get into prison camps and you get into sort of images of refugees. Mm-hmm. And this is a people who are trying to escape oppression and find carve out a land for themselves. And you don't really have a Charlton Heston telling you this is what this is about at any point. But I think that stuff is there. You don't have to dig very far to get to it.
Yeah. And I think, I guess at the end too, you have, this was what it shares with Planet of the Apes as well, is just where are we at in terms of humanity? Like, where do we stand? Who represents us? And which is in this case, you know, Woody Harrelson's Colonel. And that's a pretty disturbing, you know, given his connection to perhaps Kurtz and Apocalypse Now, or actually he'd be more in common with Robert Duvall even in Apocalypse Now. Either way, not humanity's shining moment.
I mean, it's some great imagery. It's some great like fascist imagery of him like shaving his head in front of the troops. That's some chilling stuff.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to my coworker Alyssa Wilkinson, who is the movie critic at Vox.com, and her Planet of the Apes, War for the Planet of the Apes review, which is very, very good. But she specifically talks about how the movie evokes at least four different historical periods of oppression. It evokes not just the children of Israel and Egyptian enslavement, but also movements that have used that story as inspiration for their own struggle for freedom during the American Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. It also consciously calls to mind the Holocaust, with homages to the Great Escape and soldiers styled to look like both Nazis and white supremacist militants.
So I guess you can.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I was thinking of in the first half. I kind of alluded to the fact that there's like a lot of different readings that you can attach to War for the Planet of the Apes, but they're all kind of born of this greater story of oppression that can be applied to many, many different points in history, because humans keep oppressing each other, which was the theme of the original. So there we go. Brings it full circle.
Are there more like you? More apes from zoo?
Dead. All dead. Long time.
Human
gets sick.
Ape.
Get smart. Then human kill ape. But not me. I run.
You learn to speak.
Listen, human. Bad ape. Bad ape.
I wanted to talk a little bit about who we are being asked to identify with in these two films, in terms of not necessarily who we are sympathizing with, because I don't think you necessarily need to sympathize with a character in a movie, but in terms of like whose quote unquote side we're on. And we talked a little about it in the first half with the 68 apes, and just in terms of like the ambiguity of the ending and of what Dr. Zaius is doing. But, you know, we are really on the side of the apes for most of war. But then there's the fate of the humans, you know, and the virus that is the part of war that most explicitly sets up the world of the 68 apes, the mutation of the virus that robs humans of their speech and kind of makes them regress to a more animal state. And that final scene with Woody Harrelson's character, where he kills himself rather than regress to that, is, I think, really powerful and unsettling, and similar to the way the ending of 68 Apes sort of upends your perceptions of right and wrong. That final scene with Harrelson functions in a somewhat similar way. Am I imagining that?
You can't help but feel for him and kind of, you know, the his vulnerability and you know, it doesn't excuse what he's done, but you kind of see what he thinks he's fighting against the entire time.
It's not an irrational thing to want to fight for, I don't want to say for your race, but to fight for your existence as a species, I think would be a natural impulse, and not something that we would be inclined as humans to villainize if it's humans that are indeed under threat, right?
There's an element of madness to what he's doing too, because this is a man who has had to kill his child. That unhinges a person, you know? And like I said, I don't want to say it causes you to sympathize with him, but it does add shading to what would otherwise be a pretty standard villain. So I guess I'm asking you guys, like, who you identify with in these movies as a viewer?
Well, in this film, I think almost entirely the apes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But what about Nova?
Sure. She seems nice.
I mean, obviously I'm not a little girl. Yeah. I can't talk. But like there's something redeemable there, and maybe a sign that perhaps it was not the right decision for the colonel to kill his child.
Yeah, it's unclear to me also whether they're just losing speech or losing cognitive faculties, because she seems to be as intelligent as any girl her age. She just can't talk. But it seems like people who get these diseases later kind of regress, if I'm
maybe
not...
Or it could just be like that is something that the colonel like assumed, because if you can't speak, then you're obviously a beast, you know. It may have been just like a false extrapolation on his part.
Yeah, I mean, is that does speech, the ability to communicate through language, is it essential to us being human? Obviously no. But maybe some people think it is.
There's also a couple of, I guess I'll call them, gray area characters whose names I'm struggling to find on IMDb, so I'll just describe them. But there is the human soldier who we see in the opening battle, who is communicating with the colonel on the radio, and we kind of come back to him again and again throughout the camp with the suggestion that he's carrying out orders, but he is uncomfortable with what's happening. And then we also have the guerrilla enforcer on the colonel's side, who is, like I said, an enforcer for most of the film, but does have a moment toward the end, you know, of ape solidarity, I guess. So I think those two characters are interesting mirrors
is
of each other.
Donkey, right?
They call them donkeys. Yes. Which I didn't get at first, and then they call them Kongs, Donkey
Kong.
Get it?
Yeah.
Very clever.
Okay, I didn't know that. That is clever.
I realized that about halfway through the movie. But I'm just pointing those two characters out as interesting mirrors of each other in that respect.
Yeah, and the donkeys reminded me more of Apocalypse Now, when Kurtz is settled in among the natives and they're part of his protection and are aligned with him in some way, despite him in the war intruding upon and violating, you know, their terrain. So there's the Apocalypse Now connection. But it led to such a great payoff for one of them to take the action that he does at the end.
I guess before we wrap up, I would like to talk about the action in both of these films, because, I mean, war is definitely more in the line of what we would think of as a modern action film and having big sequences. But 68 definitely has some exciting action sequences, too.
Yeah. No, I'm surprised we didn't actually talk about it in that first segment, because the scene where all the humans are on the run and the apes are trying to catch them in nets, I mean, that's a terrific
It's, I mean, yeah, Franklin Schaffner directs the heck out of that.
He does.
And imagine, it's another thing where I'd love to be able to time travel and to watch this movie knowing nothing, because that's terrifying. You know, that just the apes on horseback. I mean, that's a powerful introduction of that. And
their nets don't seem to work very well, though.
Well, you know, still, I wouldn't want to be caught in one, you know?
No.
They work eventually. They're relentless.
Right. Yeah.
And that, like, central stared air, like gallery type area, Colosseum. I don't know what the technical name for it is, but it really is a great setting for an action sequence.
For a chase scene too. The chase where he kind of goes, you kind of doubles as a tour of aspects of ape society, including that great ape funeral. Which is that's a really great sequence too. I mean, it's not, you know, there's long talky stretches of that film, but it's definitely does not skimp on the action either.
Yeah, for sure. Or even just the, what I originally thought was the opening scene until I saw the pre-credits prologue of the 68, but the ship crashing, just the way that is achieved, you know, mainly through camera movement is, I think, pretty awesome.
They have fewer tools that are at their disposal, but they use them well. I mean, one other bit of trivia with the original is it had its budget and shooting schedule cut drastically at the last minute. So it is a matter of you know, being resourceful.
What about the action in War?
It's very good.
Yeah.
it's really very good.
Are there any like sequences in particular that stand out to you?
I mean, there's that first conflict with the humans, and I think that's the one time when the movie kind of is on their side perspective wise, right? Because they're the ones approaching the apes and trying to launch this sneak attack, and then and then it's answered with extraordinary force, and then we switch perspectives later, which is interesting in itself. And then the big final battle sequence, which takes a lot of different twists and turns, and you got an avalanche. Oh my gosh.
Should have seen it coming, but I didn't see it coming.
Oh, boy,
much like them in the movie.
There's also the middle of the night raid with all those laser sights.
Yeah.
I think that's really
the laser
really
through the waterfall is a very cool moment of what's happening here.
Right.
You know?
Right. It really just straight up delivers the goods, as it were, which is kind of what it has to do. I mean, if we're talking about these new Planet of the Apes movies having to work as nine-figure blockbuster spectacles, they do that very skillfully and well.
Well, I think we have also skillfully navigated through this world. So let's wrap this up. Planet of the Apes is available through a variety of sources, including the usual streaming services and on Blu-ray, where it's accompanied by a lot of interesting extras and the fine feature-length documentary from 1998 called Behind the Planet of the Apes, which kind of walks you through the whole original series. War for the Planet of the Apes is still in theaters. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
Well, I'm going to pull a bit of an audible. I was going to recommend Step, which I think you should see if you want to see a
crowd-pleasing
documentary about steppers in an all-girls Baltimore high school. It's very much in the Spellbound tradition. It's not groundbreaking documentary filmmaking by any stretch of the imagination. You're just kind of following, you know, a few of the girls and who have, you know, different, very strong and very different personalities, but it's super satisfying and something I think you should check out. And I also wanted, of course, to make a mention of Columbus. I had talked about Koganata's essays, which are incredible, and you should check those out still. But the film Columbus is finally being released in art houses, so I would check that out just because I've been so frustrated by how boring aesthetically various Sundance films I've seen have been lately. And Columbus, you know, for all of its faults and some of its Amer indie flavor, has a beautiful look to it, and it visits this town in Indiana that's full of modernist architecture. It's kind of like someone talked about it as being like if Garden State were directed by Ozu, it would be Columbus, which is a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, second to that. I saw that movie today.
But now I'm going to just completely turn away from all that and talk about a film called The Lawnmower Man.
I'm dying to see how this happened.
So The Lawnmower Man, this came up because we were doing a list at Rolling Stone. It'll be up by the time this airs, connected to The Dark Tower, about adaptations of Stephen King's work, of which The Lawnmower Man is in name only. Stephen King had sued successfully to have his name removed because his story and the film really have almost nothing in common. But for me, if you know me, you know that I absolutely love or I'm fascinated by movies about technology, particularly ones that are super technophobic and kind of cheesy, and somehow I had not seen The Lawnmower Man, which kind of brought me back to the time when I did a Better Late Than Never on Harold and Maude. You know, I'd seen 100 films that were Harold and Maude had clearly been a direct influence, but not had seen Harold and Maude. It was just a weird blind spot. So I rectified the blind spot today by seeing The Lawnmower Man on Shout Factory Blu-ray, and oh my god, what an absolutely insane film this is. It's a film about virtual reality and how terrified we should be by it. It's a warning of this new technology that's coming and is gonna introduce mind control and is gonna erase the boundary between the real and the virtual world in a way that's gonna be just devastating for humanity. And it does it through effects that are again, I'm not going to say dated, but of their time.
They looked bad at the time. I saw this movie in the theater.
These
effects were cheesy looking.
Though. Yeah, and it's everything is played so broad. It's got Jeff Fahey is the Lawnmower Man, who's a simpleton who's recruited by Pierce Brosnan, who's a scientist, to be this sort of human guinea pig for his experience with virtual reality. And the experiments help expand his cognitive function, but it goes too far, and so this sort of half-wit turns into a godlike homicidal megalomaniac with the ability to sort of erase the line between the real world and the pixelated realm of possibility, terrifying possibility. And he does it often. There's one sequence where you have this giant virtual head of Jeff Fahey sort of zapping these cops, turning them into like digital pixels, and it's so tacky and fascinating, wonderful in its way. I just think it's like The Net, it's this technophobic freak out that we look at today and think, yeah, virtual reality. I mean, we're making jokes about it on Silicon Valley. It's not a threat at all. It's still in the phase of being a kind of a fad and nothing threatening at all. That was worth revisiting. So it's not a recommendation, but if you share my obsession and somehow haven't seen The Lawnmower Man, it was quite something, I will say that.
I just remember the phrase access denied being used
yes.
an awful lot.
Yeah, because he gets trapped in a virtual realm and he cannot get out because his access is denied many, many times. Anyway, so that's my weird little rant about The Lawnmower Man. Keith, what about you?
I want to recommend that people go a little deeper into the world of Planet of the Apes and watch the sequels to the original film, which I find really quite compelling, some more than others. But if you kind of want to know where this current trilogy comes from, a lot of them are drawn from later Planet of the Apes sequels. But just to walk you through it a little bit, there's going to be some spoilers here. The next movie is called Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which basically ends, it's not that great until the end, which actually ends with the discovery of these humans who are mutant, who are worshiping a nuclear weapon. And the film ends with the Earth being destroyed. This is the most amazing, apocalypse. Well, literally apocalyptic.
They blow it up?
They blow it up.
The maniacs.
They blow it up. But fortunately, some apes travel back in time. Our friends Cornelius and Zira and another ape played by Sal Mineo travel back in time, thus starting the whole cycle again. So you got Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And of those, I would say The best is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which really is the most, has the most in common with this current trilogy. And it's very much a rooted in the civil rights struggle and kind of imagines this world in which the apes, you know, rebel against their human masters, for which they've become sort of, you know, subhuman slaves. And it's not subtle, but it's very effective. I like that one a lot. And probably avoid Battle for the Planet of the Apes, which is not so good. But they're all written by a man named, or co-written by a man named Paul Dane, who's definitely someone who I'd love to read a full biography of, because he was a film critic and also apparently a spy in World War II. I keep thinking that maybe Michael Fassbender's character in Inglourious Basterds was somewhat inspired by Paul Dane. He's also, I don't know, open in the sense that you know, that he was walking down the street holding hands, but he was in a relationship with a man for years, and everyone knew about it. He wrote a film called Goldfinger, which I think you might like. But and then he also wrote a collection of poetry called Quake, 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 which was illustrations by Edward Gorey, including the cover, which features a couple picnicking in front of a mushroom cloud. So there's sort of a dark sensibility to his writing throughout, and it really comes through in those sequels, and I would definitely recommend checking them out.
So quick ranking. Best to worst?
The original is the best. Conquest is the second. I'd say Escape's third. Beneath is next to last. And Battle for the Planet of the Apes is a distant last. And, you know, apart from John Huston as the lawgiver, we actually meet the lawgiver, and he's played by John Huston. And it's got Paul Williams in it, too. But other than that, not so great. How about you, Genevieve?
This is not my original recommendation, but I am going to tag a little one on here and recommend something that Keith is far too modest to recommend himself. But I think we probably have some listeners who are not familiar with The Dissolve, the old website we all worked for, and therefore not familiar with the great column that Keith wrote there called The Laser Age, which examined a rich period in history of science fiction filmmaking that began in the late 1960s and faded away by the mid-1980s. So obviously, Planet of the Apes falls directly into that era and was inspiration for a couple columns you wrote there, including one called After Blowing Itself Up, the Planet of the Apes series charted new territory, which I think probably expands on what you talk about in your recommendation right there. So if you haven't had the pleasure of reading the Laser Age column, I would definitely give that a Google and treat yourself to that. But that is not my main recommendation, which is a film called Contemporary Color. This is a concert documentary from the Ross brothers, Bill and Turner Ross, which captures a very unusual performance masterminded by one David Byrne, whom we recently discussed on this podcast in the context of Stop Making Sense. Contemporary Color was the name of a live show that Byrne curated in 2015 that features 10 different contemporary musical artists, including St. Vincent, Nelly Furtado, Tuneyards, Deb Hines, and Byrne himself, performing new original songs, but with a twist. See, it turns out that Byrne is an aficionado of Color Guard, the marching band offshoot that's colloquially known as the sport of the arts, and features twirling flags, sabers, and other props integrated into contemporary dance routines. So Contemporary Color is his attempt to elevate Color Guard's perception in the wider culture by pairing 10 different Color Guard teams from across the country with 10 musicians for an evening of pure artistic spectacle. And it is nothing short of awesome. I am officially obsessed with this movie. The Ross brothers probably could have gotten away with just kind of pointing some cameras at the stage and still gotten a pretty great movie out of the deal. But they really go a step beyond with the way that they document this concert, cutting between more conventional performance and backstage footage to stuff with the teams rehearsing and interacting with each other. And they just do it in really kind of thoughtful and beautiful ways. There's a story being told here, but it's also just kind of the creation of a feeling, sort of telegraphing the passion and excitement these people have around this really niche, sort of campy, but really affecting performing art. It's just kind of a perfect marriage of artistic sensibilities. And even if you're like, what, Color Guard? Why would I ever watch that? I'd strongly recommend giving this a shot anyway, just to marvel at the filmmaking and the artistic collaboration on display. It's currently available for digital rental on a variety of services. I rented it on Amazon, and it's more than worth the $3 or $4 you'll spend to watch it.
I cannot believe I have not seen this film.
I'm personally offended you haven't seen
it yet. It's embarrassing because I keep touting the Ross brothers is I think at the end of their run they're going to be thought of like the Maisels are now. I think they're that talented. They did the film called Western. I can't remember the name of the I don't know how to pronounce the name of that New Orleans street, Chupatulus or
Chupatulus.
Chupatulus, which is a sort of a night in the life of New Orleans. They are massively talented, and some it is not surprising at all to me that they bring a lot to contemporary color. I also wanted to pile on to Genevieve's other recommendation. You know, you should check out Keith's column.
Oh, guys.
But for a couple of things. One, we did get a couple of illustrations out of our friend Sam Smith.
Yes.
That were fantastic.
One of which is still my Twitter icon.
And the other, I wanted to cite one of my favorite columns that he did, which is about a trio of films in 1978 that rushed to feed the craze for science fiction. Films such as Laser Blast and Message from Space. And it's just a great kind of footnotey type column that I had a lot of fun with. So it's a nice journey to go on, I think.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I miss writing that column. I would pick it up if anyone wanted to do a book project with it. I'm not saying I would say no.
Yeah,
I'm glad people liked it so much. And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out August 22nd and 24th. Scott, what do we have lined up?
Well, over the last three films, The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, and their latest, Detroit, writer Mark Boal and director Catherine Bigelow have been refining an approach to real historical events that combines scrupulous, documentary-like attention to detail with the visceral charge of a political thriller. We looked at several great options to pair with Detroit, which follows the events surrounding the 1967 riots in that city. We considered Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee's touchstone about racial tension and violence in New York's Bed-Stuy neighborhood. We also considered Bigelow's Strange Days, which was produced in the wake of the Rodney King trial and reflects on many of the same themes. But we ultimately decided to choose The Battle of Algiers, Giulio Pontecorvo's controversial masterpiece about terrorism and torture in the French-Algerian War. The Battle of Algiers set the standard for what Boal and Bigelow are trying to accomplish in Detroit, and it's always been a great conversation piece. If you haven't seen it, and you really should, it's available on Criterion and on the Filmstruck streaming service. It's also available for digital rental.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of the Planet of the Apes films and anything else film or ape-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave us a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
You can find me at Vox.com at the culture section there, and I'm on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
I'm on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Vulture, Variety, and other fine publications. I'm also the editor of the Oscilloscope Musings blog. Oscilloscope was a distributor of Contemporary Color.
I thought they were.
You can find our absent co-host, Tasha Robinson, on Twitter at Tasha Robinson, and you can find her all over the place at The Verge, where she works as a film and TV editor. That's also my title. I'm film and TV editorial director at uprocks.com, and you can find me on Twitter at kfips3000. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space at her home, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be a part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.